you through my father. وَكُنْتُمْ عَلَى شَفَا حُفْرَةٍ مِّنَ النَّارِ فَأَنْقَذَكُمْ مِّنْهَا. You were on the brink of the pit of the fire, but he saved you through my father. When was this khutbah given? 11 AH. Go read Nahj al-Balagha, Sermon 26. Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks, he quotes the same words of Fatim. O people, you were lowly, you drank water by the side, you worship idols, you buried your daughters until Allah saved you through Muhammad. When did Imam Ali give khutbahs after he became the Caliph of the Muslims? 37 AH. So Fatima's khutbah 11 AH, Imam Ali's khutbah 37 at the earliest. The difference is what? 26 years. 26 years later, a man who says Saluni, Saluni is quoting and taking and borrowing from Fatima alayhi salam. She cannot be an ordinary person. You cannot say she is emotional. This is knowledge that comes from a source beyond anyone's imagination. So the other argument.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Saudi Arabia in the world of politics.
Part 2.
In recent years, Saudi Arabia has been the largest buyer of arms in the world and is making great efforts to continue on this path. At the same time, it is trying to start a coalition of its friends, especially the Arab countries, against Iran.
Talk is cheap. Let's look at the actions. Saudis helped Saddam Hussein for 8 years. Saudis helped Al-Qaeda. Saudis created Daesh. Saudis created a Nusra. So they started this sectarian message, not us.
Nonsense. The Iranians are the ones who are exporting terrorism. They're the ones who are stoking the fires of sectarianism. They're the ones who are violating international laws and norms and acceptable behavior. And they're the ones who have been on an aggressive path since 1979.
Despite the fact that the United States and almost every other powerful nation supports Saudi Arabia actively and tries to undermine us actively, we are still the most influential power in the Middle East. That should tell you something. That should tell you that we have made the right choices and they've made the wrong choices.
The end of World War I was an era of reform in the world of politics. It was no longer like the days before the war, and the following years were the beginning of a new era for geographical maps. New rulers, one after another, could find their place in the world of politics. In Iran, it was Reza Shah's turn. A few years later, on the anniversary of Reza Shah's reign, Saudi King Abdul Aziz bin Saud sent him a congratulatory message. In response, on July 1st of 1928, Habibullah Hoveida was sent to Hejaz as Iran's representative so that Iran could officially begin its ties with the Saudi dynasty. During the years after these negotiations, the most important issue between the two countries was performing the Hajj and organizing the sending of Iranian pilgrims to Hejaz. It continued until 1944, when a young man named Abu Talib Yazdi and his wife decided to travel to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj. During the Tawaf, this 22-year-old man got sick in the heat of the sun and vomited. Urged by some pilgrims, Saudi officers accused him of vomiting deliberately. Abu Talib was arrested and the judge sentenced him with beheading. The sentence was carried out in public. As the bitter news of Yazdi's beheading reached Iran, a wave of protests began in the country. On January the 18th of 1944, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Iran issued a statement and sent a letter to Saudi Arabia condemning this act. In the following days, many articles condemning this act and asking the government to protest Saudi Arabia were published in newspapers. Iran did not find the Saudi government's response to the incident convincing and sent another letter of protest to Saudi Arabia on February the 7th. The lack of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia continued in the next 5 years until King Abdul Aziz sent a letter to Iranian King Mohammad Reza Pahlavi on the subject of cooperation of Islamic nations. In the letter, he also expressed his desire to establish relations between the two countries. Following these letters and with the sending of ambassadors, political relations resumed in 1948 and the issue of Hajj was on the agenda. The Saudi embassy in Tehran announced that it would do its utmost to ensure the security of Iranian pilgrims. In 1958, General Abdul Karim Qasim staged a coup in Iraq. It resulted in overthrowing the monarchy and establishing a republic in the country, a coup that worried both the monarchies of Iran and Saudi Arabia. Qasim was the first head of government in Iraq who claimed that the two Iranian cities of Khorramshahr and Abadan belonged to Iraq. His government also had a clear interest in the Soviet Union. These positions were good reasons for Iran and Saudi Arabia to become closer to one another and become enemies of Iraq. In 1964, King Saud, the second king of Saudi Arabia, died at the age of 67, and his crown prince, King Faisal, came to power. The new king of Saudi Arabia traveled to Iran on his first foreign trip in 1964. Following this visit, the Iran-Saudi Arabia Friendship Association was founded under the chairmanship of the then Prime Minister of Iran, Amir Abbas Hoveida, and bilateral relations expanded from the political and economic spheres to scientific and cultural issues. A few years later, in 1973, Saudi students received scholarships in some fields, including law and medicine in Iran, as Tehran signed a contract to establish a medical college in Riyadh. Oil has always played a decisive role in Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. But one of the most important turning points in this story is the Yom Kippur War between Egypt and Israel in 1973, which led to an oil shock back then. Through Saudi Arabia, the U.S. tried to force Iran to reduce oil prices, and in this regard, contacts and meetings were held between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but neither of them decreased oil prices. In contrast, to satisfy the Americans, Saudi Arabia increased its oil production from 8.3 to 10 million barrels per day. The increase in production, which eventually led to a drop in oil prices, made the Iranian king criticize Saudi Arabia. King Faisal was assassinated by one of the Saudi princes on April the 1st of 1975. This worried all the allies of the Saudi family, especially the King of Iran. Almost a month later, in May of 1975, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi visited the new king of Saudi Arabia, King Khalid, to indicate the relations with that country were important to him. But no one knew that it was the last visit of the Pahlavi king to Saudi Arabia, and the next victim of the world of politics would be him. The Islamic Revolution in Iran changed all equations in the region, and Iran's relationship with Saudi Arabia was an important part of this transformation. Now, there was no sign of a two columns coalition between Iran and Saudi Arabia in the region, and whatever used to be a matter of closeness between the two countries became a factor of distance.
The people were in a frenzy to catch just a glimpse of the man they revere like a god. They clawed and clambered and ran to see and be near him for 15 miles. And no more than a tiny fraction of the multitude succeeded.
The initial reaction of the Saudi officials to the victory of the Islamic Revolution can be called a conservative one. King Khalid, in his first reaction, called the establishment of an Islamic government in Iran a prelude to greater rapprochement and understanding between the two countries. 3 months after the victory of the revolution in April of 1979, a Saudi delegation traveled to Iran. In a meeting with Iran's Imam Khomeini, the leader emphasized the role of Islam in the victory of Muslims, emphasized Islamic unity, reminded of the danger of Israel, and expressed hope that the Saudis' behavior towards Iranian pilgrims would improve. On November the 21st of 1979, an event took place in Mecca that shocked the Islamic world. While the Imam of Masjid al-Haram was preparing for the morning congressional prayer, a group led by Juhayman al-Otaibi entered the Masjid al-Haram and killed several officers. The rebels were members of the Salafist community and were staunch opponents of the Saudi monarchy. After the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, the New York Times was just one of American media outlets which linked the occupiers to Iran. But the next day, Interior Minister Prince Nayef issued a statement stressing the reports that Iran is involved in this matter are completely false and baseless. Finally, after 2 weeks of fighting, with the help of French forces sent to Saudi Arabia, the occupiers of Masjid al-Haram were arrested and 62 members of the group were executed, along with Juhayman. Simultaneously with the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, an unforeseen event in the eastern region of Saudi Arabia made the Saudi rulers angry with Iran. Shias in this area marched on the day of Ashura, demanding their civil rights while they were holding pictures of Imam Khomeini. The Saudi rulers, who were still involved in the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, reacted harshly to the incident, which resulted in 24 deaths on the day of Ashura in 1979. In an interview in January of 1980, the new U.S. President Ronald Reagan stated, "We will not allow Saudi Arabia to become another Iran and fall into the hands of those who want to cut off the vital flow of oil to the West." The liberation of the Iranian city of Khorramshahr from Iraqi forces on May the 24th of 1982 is an important milestone in the Ba'athist regime's imposed war against Iran. This upset all the equations of Iraq's leader Saddam Hussein and his supporters, including Saudi Arabia. When Iran achieved success in the war, it led to unprecedented Saudi financial aids to Saddam. According to official reports, Saudi Arabia provided more than $60 billion to Saddam during the war, and this kind of support continued until the end of the war. In June of 1985, the Saudi foreign minister visited the Islamic Republic of Iran for the first time. Saud al-Faisal's agenda was to improve the ties between the two countries and to encourage Iran to conduct peace negotiations with Iraq. In the same year, Iranian foreign minister Ali Akbar Velayati also visited Saudi Arabia. It did not bring much development in the relations between the two countries, but reduced the spread of tension. But among the events between the two countries, the Hajj of 1987 is one of the bitterest days in Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. The Saudi security forces' behavior towards Iranian pilgrims dates back to the disavowal of polytheists in Hajj in the post-revolutionary years. It is annoying for the Saudi authorities to hear the slogans "Death to America" and "Death to Israel," particularly because the US is the main ally of the Saudis. During the Hajj of 1987, more than 400 pilgrims were martyred, 323 of whom were Iranians. Of course, this is a statistic announced by Saudi officials. After this massacre, the Saudi officials said that the reason for this behavior towards Iranian pilgrims was their decision to capture Masjid al-Haram and move the Kaaba to Qom in Iran. Finally, on April the 26th of 1987, Saudi Arabia severed political ties with Iran. Shortly after the end of the Iraq-Iran war, Arab countries demanded repayment of the money they had given to Saddam during the war, and Kuwait was at the forefront of these creditors. Iraq's Ba'athist regime, which considered itself to be the representative of the Arab world against Iran, refused to repay its debt. Saddam also called for a reduction in oil production by Arab countries so that he could rebuild the ruins of war by raising oil prices, a request that was opposed by Arab countries, especially Kuwait. The continuation of tensions led to Saddam's invasion of Kuwait on August 2nd of 1990, an event that shocked the whole world, especially the Arab friends of the Ba'athist regime. The Iraqi army even crossed Kuwait and entered the Saudi city of Al-Khafji. The continuation of this campaign could seriously endanger the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
A U.S.-led coalition of 35 countries quickly formed to oust Saddam's army from Kuwait. Arab countries that thought Iran might side with Saddam welcomed Iran's neutrality, which resulted in the resumption of talks to improve relations with Arab countries, especially Saudi Arabia. In the 1990s, a new era of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia began that was unprecedented in the years following the Iranian Revolution. In a meeting in June of 1991, the new president of Iran, Hashemi Rafsanjani, called Iran and Saudi Arabia two wings of the Islamic world. A few months later, officials from the two sides met at the Islamic Unity Conference, and Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah invited Hashemi Rafsanjani on a pilgrimage. In the winter of 1998, an important event took place in Tehran. The 8th Summit of Islamic Countries began in the Iranian capital on December the 7th with the participation of the vast majority of heads of Islamic countries and high-ranking officials from 55 Muslim nations. The Saudi delegation is attending the conference at the highest level. For the first time since the Iranian Revolution, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia traveled to Iran to meet senior officials of the Islamic Republic. Relations that had begun in the early 1990s reached their highest level that promised different years ahead. A few months later, an agreement was reached between Tehran and Riyadh in the fields of industrial activities, transportation, environment, sports, and tourism. According to the agreement, the travel ban on citizens in eastern Saudi Arabia, who are mostly Shias, was lifted and Iran held a trade fair there. After that, direct flights were established from Dammam in Saudi Arabia to Tehran and Mashhad in Iran. The ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia were slowly and cautiously improving in the following years. But an event completely changed the relations in the world of politics. On the morning of September the 11th of 2001, several U.S. airliners changed their predetermined routes and targeted some major centers in different U.S. cities. The world was shocked by this operation, which was somehow like a science fiction movie. Shortly after the attacks, the U.S. administration under President George W. Bush announced its official account. 19 members of Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden, were responsible for planning and carrying out the operation. Interestingly, 15 of the perpetrators of this operation were Saudi nationals. Saudi Arabia was in the spotlight of the world media, and the important question was how these people were able to carry out these attacks. The days that followed September the 11th were difficult ones for the rulers of Saudi Arabia.
Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
The United States formed a large coalition to fight terrorism and immediately attacked Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan were among the few countries which had recognized the Taliban in the previous years.
War on terror is not confined strictly to the Al-Qaeda. The war on terror involves Saddam Hussein. Because of the nature of Saddam Hussein, the history of Saddam Hussein, and his willingness to terrorize himself. Saddam Hussein has terrorized his own people. He's terrorized his own neighborhood. He is a danger.
Shortly after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, its war machine shifted to Iraq. With the U.S.-led coalition attack, the Ba'athist regime, controlled by Saddam Hussein, was overthrown, something that had not happened even after the invasion of Kuwait. Now, Saudi Arabia felt that it had lost the game to Iran in two fronts.
This was central Baghdad today, as Saddam Hussein's regime finally lost control.
The statue of Saddam Hussein.
Iran had important enemies on the other side of both its eastern and western borders that had now fallen, and Saudi Arabia was not pleased with this victory and the change of balance of power by the United States.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Donald Trump has shied away from criticizing white supremacist Nick Fuentes, but his one-time number two, Mike Pence, called on the ex-president to apologize for the dinner. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more details. Donald Trump repeatedly refused to disavow the outspoken anti-Semite and white supremacist Nick Fuentes after they spoke over dinner at his Mar-a-Lago resort, rejecting the advice from advisers over fears he might alienate a section of his base, two people familiar with the situation have said. The former U.S. president was urged publicly and privately to denounce Nick Fuentes in the aftermath of the dinner, which included the performer Kanye West, who has also recently been propagating anti-Semitic remarks. But Donald Trump eschewed making outright disavowals of Nick Fuentes, the people said, and none of the statements from the campaign or on his Truth Social account included criticism of Fuentes, despite efforts from advisers who reached Trump over the Thanksgiving holiday. Donald Trump ultimately made clear that he fundamentally did not want to criticize Nick Fuentes, a product of his dislike of confrontation and his anxiety that it might antagonize a devoted part of his base, and became more entrenched in his obstinance the more he was urged to do so. Across three statements on Friday, Donald Trump initially sought only to play down the dinner and made no mention of Nick Fuentes or his views, before saying angrily in a post on his Truth Social website that evening that Kanye West expressed no anti-Semitism and I didn't know Nick Fuentes. The line about not knowing Nick Fuentes was the closest that Trump came to acknowledging the offensive nature of the dinner, under pressure from advisers who warned him that being associated with a racist and a Holocaust denier could further damage his personal brand, as well as his recently launched 2024 presidential bid. But even with his ignorance of Nick Fuentes taken at face value, the statements signal Trump will give extraordinary deference to the most fringe elements of his base, even if it means potentially losing support for more moderate Republicans who have not typically cared for his indulgence of extremism. Donald Trump has had a long history of delaying or muting criticism of white supremacy, drawing moral equivalency in 2017 between neo-Nazis and counter-protesters at the deadly unrest in Charlottesville, Virginia, and refusing to denounce the far-right Proud Boys militia group at the 2020 presidential debate. The halting response to Nick Fuentes most closely mirrored his inability to condemn white supremacist groups after Charlottesville, the people said, when Trump faced intense criticism for not naming the right-wing groups in the bloodshed that ended with the death of a young woman. When reached for comment, the Trump 2024 campaign said the former president had a record of combating anti-Semitism, including the appointment of a special envoy to combat anti-Semitism, and strengthening ties to Israel by recognizing Israel's annexation of Golan Heights. The circumstances of the dinner at Mar-a-Lago on Tuesday, though, have been a new source of consternation for aides, who privately concede that Kanye West should never have been allowed to meet with Donald Trump in the first place, given his own recent anti-Semitic history. Donald Trump had intended to meet with Kanye West one-on-one for some time, according to a person briefed on the matter, though it was postponed around the time that Kanye West tweeted offensive tropes against Jews, only for it to be inexplicably rescheduled for late November. The former president ended up meeting with Nick Fuentes, who was at the unrest in Charlottesville, Virginia, after he came along with Kanye West and a former Trump campaign aide, Karen Giorno. There was only a skeleton staff from Trump's 45 office at the property ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday. During the dinner, the person said Nick Fuentes told Donald Trump he was among the former president's supporters, but that he had been unimpressed with the 2024 campaign launch speech because it appeared stilted instead of appearing authentic, with his ad-libs and off-the-cuff remarks. The website Politico.com has also covered the same story and gives us more details. A flurry of top Republicans on Monday, 28th of November, took a familiar approach to Donald Trump's dinner with white nationalist and anti-Semite Nick Fuentes, condemning the former president's actions, but not the man himself. Donald Trump's one-time number two, Mike Pence, was a notable exception, though. President Trump was wrong to give a white nationalist and anti-Semite a seat at the table, Mike Pence told News Nation in an interview. He added, and I think he should apologize for it. Trump's vice president joined several GOP members of Congress in blasting Trump's dinner last week with Nick Fuentes, who has often shared racist and Holocaust-denying content online, and the rapper Kanye West, who has also made anti-Semitic comments. The former president's decision to dine with Nick Fuentes and Kanye West soon after launching his 2024 presidential campaign has already sparked widespread condemnation from Democrats, but Republican lawmakers have been slower to speak out, and most who did so on Monday, 28th of November, stopped short of Mike Pence's call for an apology from Donald Trump. Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican senator from Florida who vied against Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential primary, said he hopes to see the former president condemn Nick Fuentes, because I know Trump's not an anti-Semite. I can tell you that for a fact that Trump is not. But Fuentes is evil, just a nasty, disgusting person. And he's trying to legitimize himself by being around a former, maybe a future president. Other Republicans frowned upon the meeting itself while stopping short of outright condemnation. The Senate GOP's number two leader, John Thune of South Dakota, called the dinner a bad idea on every level and said whomever on Donald Trump's staff advised it should be fired. It's ridiculous that he had that meeting, said Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican senator from Iowa, another member of GOP leadership, and that's all I'm going to say about it. Just crazy. Senator Steve Daines, a Republican senator from Montana, condemned the idea of anti-Semitism generally when asked about the meeting, but went no further. We cannot tolerate anti-Semitism, period, said Senator Daines, who's set to chair Senate Republicans' campaign arm for the 2024 election. Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota said he wasn't going to condemn anybody, adding that Nick Fuentes is just not somebody that I would have a meeting with. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri struck a similar note, saying while he wouldn't personally dine with Nick Fuentes, it's a free country and Trump can do whatever he wants. Both Senator Mike Rounds and Senator John Cornyn, a Republican senator from Texas, a close ally of Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, said they didn't know who Nick Fuentes was. I'm really not going to spend any more time worrying about whether or not those two people are meeting with one another, Senator Rand said. Since his pre-Thanksgiving dinner with Nick Fuentes and Kanye West, Donald Trump also has said he did not know who Nick Fuentes was when the latter, who joined scores of other white nationalists in attending the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that turned violent, came to dinner at Mar-a-Lago as a guest of Kanye West. The dinner was intended to be Kanye and me only, Trump said in a post on his Truth Social platform, shying away from direct criticism of Nick Fuentes. Before Senate Republicans returned to Washington on Monday evening, one of their own had already tweeted, with notably sharp criticism. Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican senator from Louisiana who voted to convict Donald Trump at his second impeachment trial, sought to put distance between Trump's actions and the Republican Party as a whole. President Trump hosting racist anti-Semites for dinner encourages other racist anti-Semites, Senator Cassidy tweeted. He added, "These attitudes are immoral and should not be entertained. This is not the Republican Party."
Stand here, so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly, she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini wa'adham ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about banking in this episode and the upcoming episodes, hopefully, or inshallah, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we start our program, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the Islamic laws related to banking and financial matters according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about banking and financial matters, let me ask you this question, you know. Is it permissible to deposit any sum of money in a bank and authorize the bank officials to invest the same amount, right, in any Sharia transaction without demanding any specific share of the profits or any interest, but on the understanding that the bank would give the investor, basically you, his share or your share of the profits every 6 months, for example? Is that permissible?
Well, there's no objection to this type of deposit if the money is left with the bank with unrestricted freedom, like choosing this type, like, for example, allowing the bank to choose this type of investment and specifying the investor's share of the profit on their behalf. So, actually, it is when the bank is allowed to do this and to invest the money, the bank represents the client. The bank acts on behalf of the depositor. And, of course, there's no problem in this kind of transaction because the bank is supposed to invest the money or use the money in any lawful or legal investment or contract. And so there's no problem, there's no objection either in taking the profit made by investing the money. The profit which is given by the bank to the depositor is also permissible because the transaction was legal in the first place. And of course, there should also be no problem if the investor was ignorant of the size of the share of the profit, you know, when he was depositing the money, because he did not know how much profit he was going to receive. So even if he was ignorant, the transaction is still allowed and permissible.
Mm-hmm. I see. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to actually deal with or work with those banks of the foreign countries that are, like, let's say, in enmity with the Muslim world or with the Muslims in general. Is it permissible actually to, for example, deposit any money in a kind of long-term savings account in those banks?
Well, according to the answer given by His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no problem in the transaction in and of itself. Of course, there's no problem. It's permissible to deposit money in the banks of non-Muslim countries.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a condition. Depositing is allowed in and of itself,
right,
provided that this does not lead to strengthening the economy and the power or political power, the economic power of those countries that are working against Islam and the Muslims. If it does not strengthen, if it does not, help those countries gain more power and more strength, then there's no problem in the in depositing money in their banks and also working in those banks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid, is answering some of these questions, in fact, related to the banking and the financial matters, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, we know that there are some banks that work in different areas in the Muslim world, right? And some of them are not owned by the Muslims themselves. Some of them are owned by non-Muslim countries or some private sector somewhere else. Okay?
Yes.
So is the dealing permissible, or are the dealings that you do or any Muslims do with those banks permissible on the condition that, that I said earlier, like the banks are owned by even repressive regimes, for example, all right, or non-Muslim countries, regardless of whether they're owned by or some of the shareholders are Muslim or not?
Well, of course, it depends largely on the type of the transactions made or carried out by the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, there is no objection to being a party to any Shari'i or lawful and permissible transaction conducted by the banks. And, if the transactions are riba-free or usury-free,
mm-hmm,
and it's not based on usury, then there is no problem. And there's no objection to someone, to that party, receiving the interest or getting the interest from those banks. And of course, say it again, that taking riba or usury from Muslim banks or institutions is not permissible unless the capital of the bank is owned by non-Muslims. Of course, if there is a bank which is run by Muslims, but the capital of the bank belongs to Muslims, of course, in that case, it is permissible to receive interest from that bank.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sheikh Javid, we all know that usually it is the case that in the Islamic banking system, that the depositors receive some licit profit interest for their deposits, all right? Wherever they invest their money, the banks, they do it in different ways as they see suitable for themselves, all right? Well, is it permissible for individuals. I mean, like private sectors, like you and me, basically, yes. To adopt the same practice as the banks. All right. Well, in other words, is it permissible that you lend money to people in the marketplace, for example, and invest like as they see fit?
Well, if the money is given to the other party in the form of a loan with the condition that the recipient pays monthly or yearly interest at a certain percentage, mm-hmm. of course such a transaction is haram. You know, as a matter of religious law or as a matter of, you know, Sharia law. Because Sharia law does not allow receiving interest or receiving riba. And this transaction is a kind of riba because you as an individual gave money to someone mm-hmm. to who is working in the market and you receive money on a monthly or monthly basis, of course.
Right.
And, of course, in the event that you stipulate or you place a condition that the other person, the investor, should give you a certain amount of money on a monthly basis. So this is nothing but usury. And as I did mention, if it is a kind of transaction, a legal transaction, something like partnership or ju'ala, or let's say a silent partnership, there's no objection to receiving the money because it is the transaction, it is the partnership that makes things halal. So both the investors are actually investing money, they are joint, it's a kind of joint venture with two people, with two parties working together to earn profit. And in that case, the profit which is given by the depositor, which is given to the depositor, is obviously halal. And let me also further add that if the money is deposited with the other party to invest in a Shari type, this is to just paraphrase my mm-hmm. my previous answer. If the money is given by the other party to invest in a Shari type of work or in accordance with a Shari contract, and the money owner gets a given share of the profit mm-hmm. made,
yes.
such a transaction is obviously sound, it is valid, and the profits made are also treated as halal, and there's no objection to someone to that individual, to that party receiving the money.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. The topic was the Islamic laws about, or the questions about the Islamic laws related to banking and financial matters. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.